Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome everyone to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Now in its third season, we're having a fascinating set of conversations about industries in transitions, about partnerships, about how organizations are challenging themselves to find value with others. And that brings a whole set of new capabilities, shared purpose, and new resources to bear on the kind of challenges that are worth tackling. And so today in our virtual studio, I'm so glad to welcome Trevor Gosling. Trevor, we've had a few conversations so far. It's been fascinating to watch your organizations grow and connect with other financial services firms in various forms of partnership. So I think it's a great story to share with our audiences and to tap into your insights or growing a business and the kind of partnerships and the thinking that goes behind it. So great to have you in our virtual studio this morning. Thank you for making time for this. And then please tell us a little about yourself.
Thanks for having me, Saul. So Trevor Gosling, currently the co-founder, CEO of Lulalend. We're actually going through a rebrand and we'll be known as Lula going forward. A chartered accountant by qualification, but really sort of went on my own entrepreneurial journey, which was always a burning passion within me that I had to build companies, and that's what excites me.
That's exciting. That's excellent. Trevor, I'm always conscious that entrepreneurial businesses start off as an idea in someone's head. Very often, the kind of ambition that one has for an organization, whether a commercial entity or a nonprofit, an organization with predominantly a social cause, whatever that purpose is, whatever ambition crystallizes from it, that origin is very often starting well before it is an entity, an organization. It has a team around it, et cetera, et cetera. So tell us a little bit about your origin story. How did Lula start when it was perhaps just a conviction, just a gut feel at the beginning that things could be done better and differently? Maybe not everyone understood the story as well right at the beginning. I imagine you didn't have the immaculate presentation to showcase it at, but I'm always conscious and curious about what was that origin story? How did it start and the why behind it?
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, for me, it was a bit of a journey leading up to Lula in terms of the roads I'd gone down. I'd been, you know, very much in corporate, wrapping up my articles, and then spent the next 5 years in investment banking. But always with the sense that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, that I wanted to build something, but sort of fell, I fell into my first e-commerce business through my brother and his business partner. They started Groupon South Africa and were really successful there. And I thought, all right, I need to be in the digital space. I got to make the leap out of investment banking and start up something there, because it seems this is where it's hot and happening. And that led me on a journey for the next 3-4 years with a really nice story in the end that I was able to exit this e-commerce company to Naspers. But if I look back on things, I'd never really taken the time to deeply think through what I wanted to be doing on a daily basis. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur and I wanted to build things, but I didn't know exactly, you know, what I wanted to build and what made sense to me. And it was really only post the Naspers acquisition that I had time. I had a bit more financial freedom. You know, I didn't have to jump into something immediately. So I could really think more reflectively over my life and looking internally and what sort of makes sense for me as a human in terms of what I want to be doing. And, you know, I came to the realization that I didn't want to just build a commercial enterprise. It needed to be something that was really purpose-driven, that I believed was going to help, you know, the South African economy in one way, shape or form. And I started marrying that idea with my prior experience in the digital world of building my first business, you know, understanding tech. At the same time, I knew I wanted to get out of e-commerce and I wanted to get back into financial services. And that led me down the road of fintech and what was happening in fintech back in 2014 globally. And it wasn't really a word used in South Africa. It was definitely a buzzword in more developed markets. But I could really see the effect, the positive effect that technology was having on developed markets. And I knew you know, we could very easily transition a lot of what was happening there into an emerging market, South Africa, and could really help uplift the segments. And the segments I'd identified with SMEs, I'd, you know, always had a passion for building business and had a lot of friends and family who were running SMEs. So was closely involved in that. So when I married it all together with fintech and enabling SMEs, that really became my calling and passion. I knew, you know, this, I don't know exactly how it's going to look and play out, but this is the area that I wanted to impact. And I really just spent a good 2-3 months diving into the sector, into fintech itself, diving into the South African SME economy, the African SME economy, and understanding where it is and what it drives. And, you know, finding some massive indicators that this is a hugely neglected segment of the market, but also a massive opportunity in that, you know, over 60% of private workforce is employed by SMEs. SMEs generate upwards of 40% of GDP to our economy, and it's similar to other emerging markets. So the fact that this segment of the market was so underserviced in financial services really just spoke to me wholeheartedly that this was the road I needed to go down, and this is something that I had to focus my efforts on building for.
You know, Trevor, when we speak with entrepreneurs, whether they are intrapreneurs within larger organizations, I can think back, for example, you've shared with me, you've previously been with RMB, but many other organizations that we come across and work with, as well as entrepreneurs that are on their own, that are starting new businesses, they all speak about the value of that quiet time, that value of having thinking space as much as doing space. And they'll speak of it in different languages. You know, they'll speak of it in terms of, you know, physically having the space away from others to think. Some of them refer specifically to the pandemic and the time that gave them to interact less with others and to carve out that space physically. Others will speak about conversations that change them with mentors. Some will speak about fortuitous connections with others that help them to think very differently, to kind of discover the kind of challenges they want to develop, as well as the kind of passion and sense of purpose that kind of galvanizes over time. So kind of wonder if you can take us a little bit into that time in which you had that space to create this kind of purpose-driven organization. What could you share with us about that part of the journey?
Yeah, so at that point, it was really the first time in my life that I thought, well, I said to myself, so I'm naturally like really operational and I like to get into things wholeheartedly and put my head down, you know, once I got an idea. But it was the first time that I really told myself, let's just take a step back. There's absolutely no pressure to need to jump or dive into anything at any point in time. Let's just spend the time researching, going to conferences, meeting up with people, or getting connected at least with people that are closer to the industry. So in this respect, just getting onto fintech and see, you know, who are the movers and shakers in the fintech market on a global level, and really just being pretty brazen and reaching out to a lot of these CEOs or founding teams and seeing if they were happy to chat. And in a number of instances, they were. And you just start building this clarity in terms of what they've done and how they've gone about achieving it and how, you know, a lot of that can be replicated, and I wouldn't necessarily say improved upon it, but you could fit it within a, you know, different market context and still make a success of it. So these were just tactics I was using, you know, not putting any pressure on myself that I need to have a business plan finalized at any point in time. It was really, you know, let it just come more organically and naturally as you build up clarity around, you know, what's happening globally and how you believe things can be impacted locally. And then it was, you know, a lot of, you know, introductions to, you know, businesses and in ecosystems I wasn't even aware of. I mean, I knew I had this, you know, purpose-driven mission that I wanted to pursue, but I wasn't as clear on the sort of, you know, there were a lot of global companies who have developed business models with very, very similar ambitions, and venture capital companies, and you know, very importantly, as you're going on starting a business, you know, raising capital is a big component of it. But identifying venture capital businesses that are purpose-driven were for me, you know, when you talk to the sort of fortuitous interactions or meetings, you know, this wasn't something that a world that I understood at all. But meeting with a lot of these venture capital companies who wanted to support early stage startup businesses and, you know, really believe in what they're doing and the ability to really affect economies and drive financial inclusion and help create jobs. You know, this also gave me a far better sense of clarity in terms of, you know, I have in my mind this idea in terms of what I want to achieve, but there are actually big supporters out there who are happy to put the necessary funds and capital behind these types of businesses. And so, you know, that was this sort of 3-month period and journey that I went through, but it really teed up the company to go into its next phase or actually start building. And to be honest, haven't in the last 6 or 7 years, haven't had the opportunity to really spend as much time, good portion of time like that, to reflect on things. But I think it's definitely something that is worthwhile during someone's career to constantly take that time to reflect back and think through ideas and where they're headed.
Trevor, I'm just curious, is that something that you were able to sustain or in some way to adjust your management style once the business has kind of been set up and is growing? Was that kind of a period that you look back and say, I wish I had more of that? I'm kind of looking forward to the next kind of chunk of time where I can take quiet space. I'm just curious, has it changed the way in which you manage, prioritize your time and engage with others?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I've also realized, you know, as a business goes through a journey of evolving as a co-founder or as a CEO, your role is constantly changing. I think it was Brian Chesky, he's the co-founder, CEO of Airbnb, and he talks about, you know, it's like evolving to different sports in terms of how your day-to-day goes. You know, you start off as a American football player and you end up as a basketball player. I mean, this is how different your job is from sort of year to year and season to season. So, I mean, I think I've always kept, well, I suppose the sort of really deep diving and thinking into, you know, what I wanted to build and being more strategic about things has been a constant reminder to me. So, you know, I definitely take the time regularly to be able to reflect on where we're going and making sure we headed towards our North Star. But I think, you know, as you go through a business journey, those things change. So if I think about, you know, when we were a 20-person company, you know, you're still deeply, deeply entrenched in operational areas across everywhere in the business. Fast forward to where we are at this point in time, you know, over 100 employees, and you've got a sizable management team that are you know, more involved in their day-to-day and managing their teams, and you're more, you know, really just involved with the management team. It does provide you with additional time and opportunity to think differently and be more strategic in your thinking, but all the time making sure that your business is pointed towards the North Star of where you're going. And always thought it would be a whole lot easier when you've got a more sizable team and you've got a sort of big management structure, but you actually realize that your ability to affect change in the organization becomes a whole lot more diluted. And with that in mind, you constantly have to be on the pulse and checking in, obviously more from a high level point of view, but checking in to make sure that you're not going off piece, so to speak, in terms of where the company's headed.
Mm. Talking about vision, one of the areas that we've spoken about previously was, where is financial services progressing towards in terms of the shift from kind of a standalone model to an embedded model? When we speak about embedded finance, for example, and I know you've shared with me previously the perspective that you have around embedded finance and the role that Lula as an organization can play in that. Maybe share with us a bit more about your vision for embedded finance. How do you see that shaping and taking form and being adopted? What is the kind of future which you infuse your team, partners, and others and get them to steep themselves in order then for the operations to work in the way that you're looking to, you know, for people to connect the dots, to be able to take that vision and run forward with? Share with us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so very early on in the life cycle of Lula, I realized that partnership opportunities were always going to be a massive component to the business. We're effectively solving for lending to SMEs, so making sure SMEs get quick, easy access to finance, because we know through the incumbents, it's pretty hard. And most of the time, smaller SMEs actually aren't approved for funding because they don't have the necessary security or whatever that the banks typically want to reduce their risk loads. So I always had this vision that we're building this technology. Surely we can be embedding this type of product into other organizations that made sense. But very early on, I realized, you know, as we were starting out the company, partnership activity and being able to correctly embed or help empower other technology companies to offer your solution to their merchant base is a lot of work in terms of, you know, customizing, build, and supporting the partner through the process. And it doesn't just stop when the product's launched in market. In fact, that's actually when things really get going, and you need a full team to support that activity to make it sure it's effective. So although I knew that the opportunity was there, it was only really in 2018, 2019, when we had just gone through a Series A raise, that we could focus our efforts a whole lot more on this side of the business. And at that point in time, we had raised the capital so we could actually build out a full comprehensive partnerships team that were focused on embedded financial services. And then we really started talking to the markets and understanding who out there made sense as partners for us. And we saw potentially a big opportunity with the current incumbent banks to be able to help improve their financial services offering to a lot of their merchants. You know, our customers are banking with your bigger banks, yet we're providing them with these financial services capabilities. So that was our initial thinking. Let's see what conversations I had there. But we very quickly came to realize that in the South African context, at least, it's a lot of work to be able to successfully partner with a bank, and could actually spend 3-4 years just going through conversations and that sort of thing. And so we sort of, as we were sort of understanding the market, shied away from that opportunity and thought, all right, let's see what other low-hanging fruit there is. And it became very clear to us that companies that are already in the technology space, that already have a payments or financial services relationship with a client in another way, made sense to offer as a partner opportunity. So examples of companies that we've come to partner with and embed our services in are the likes of Takealot. So they have 10,000 SMEs that sell products through their marketplace. And with, you know, speaking to Takealot and the ability to acquire anonymized transactional data on their clients, as well as stockholding data, we very quickly came to being able to develop a financial services product and model that we could deploy to their base and, you know, successfully service them. From there, we spoke to the likes of Vodacom. Similarly, they got a big SME network, access to a lot of data points on their customers, and the ability for us to work together with Vodacom to develop what today is VodaLend became a clear reality in terms of how that could look. And more recently, in the last couple of years, we partnered with Yoko. So Yoko, they're a, you know, mobile point of sale company, also offering financial services solution to merchants, and have very rich data on their merchant basis. And again, through a partnership, giving us the ability to use our technological expertise, our operational expertise around lending and that whole environment, to successfully come together and help support a mass network of SMEs to be able to access funding quickly and easily, help grow their businesses and help take them to the next level. So in terms of how we see this looking longer term, I still feel like we're very much at the infancy of a lot of these partnerships, and we continue to talk to similar players who have similar ambitions. Important for us that we've noticed that to be successful in a partnership, you have to have massive buy-in from the other party. You know, we always going in with full buy-in from our side because we know the potential. But from a partnership side, you need the business to be, you know, 100% committed to making this successful for their merchants or SME base. And we've had instances where, you know, the commitment is a whole lot lighter. And from big listed South African businesses who on paper it made sense, they have big SME bases, but they didn't have a commitment to the technology and the necessary integrations that needed to happen. And then sort of post that the operational execution of these partnerships to make sure that they take off. So we think we're still at the infancy of where this is all headed, but we understand what is going to make them successful and what is going to make them build out and become a whole lot more comprehensive.
Mm. Trevor, it really sounds to me that, you know, when I think about embedded finance, there are multiple models of partnerships required to really make it work. And I'm thinking kind of the one end, the likes of Symphony, for example, who's been on our podcast recently. We spoke to the global head of solutions a couple of weeks back, and they were talking about a kind of fully embedded model where fully private labeled, no one knows that it's Symphony. In fact, it's enabling and powering it to more visible forms of alliances, and in some cases, lighter forms of collaboration and partnering. But the one thing that I guess was similar across these was the focus on the customer and the willingness to then discover the right partnering form, that we may not have the perfect platform, the perfect model that people simply sign on and buy into our way of working. But from everything you're describing, it sounds like there's a lot of experimentation that takes place, that commercializing these types of partnerships and enabling customers really as a kind of a shared passion for the SME, the ultimate client we're trying to serve here. And you're really solving together a real challenge, something that you can both identify with. The mechanics of how that works may change from partner to partner. Imagine your partnership, for example, with Vodacom, or for our international audiences, Vodafone as a group would be quite different to what it would be for an e-commerce player like Takealot. So perhaps talk us a little bit about that. I guess I may want to call it a dilemma, or at least a tension between wanting to have a very clear vision and kind of one way of going about implementing on the vision. But on the other hand, as you solve these different problems or different challenges, there may be more than one model that you apply. It depends on who you work with and their capabilities and their willingness, light or otherwise, to, you know, to partner fully with you. So I'd love your thoughts about how do you go about managing that tension. Reality is always a bit messier than the kind of the page or the business plan calls for, and it may not be the ideal platform that we may have in mind as we start off with. I'm just very curious about that part.
Yeah, well, what we realized very early on is that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, which would obviously make life a whole lot easier, but it's not. Every partnership is different, from the commercial elements around how the partnership functions and operates to the more technical integration level and how that is built out. So you're right, in the early days, it was a lot of sort of experimentation and, you know, seeing what the partner was willing to do and what made sense on our side in terms of what we could commit to building and making sure that there was, you know, sufficient alignment that we all go ahead with how that structure looks, and then, you know, look to tweak things from there. But from our side, I think we picked up very early on that being able to customize and make sure that we're as flexible as possible to these partners was hugely important for our success. We couldn't, you know, have a rigid platform where for a partnership to make sense, X or Y, it couldn't be developed. We knew we had to be flexible, that there had to be customizable components to our development, that as we sat with a partner and understood their base, the dates on their customers, how we were going to feed things between ourselves, making sure that there was, you know, enough elements there that could be customized to make sure that this was a solution that was going to work in their environment. But as we've gone through a handful of experiments and, you know, a couple of partnerships that weren't successful and ones that we've seen, you know, really take off and really be successful, we've sort of, you know, come to a very clear understanding of the elements that are needed to make sure that a partnership is successful. So we approach any discussions with partners in a very different way at this point in time, because we feel, you know, we've done this before. We know how to make sure that we're giving the partnership every chance of success. And we're far more guiding of the partner at this point in time. I think in the first few iterations in the earlier days, it was a case of, you know, 50-50 between us and the partner, trying to understand exactly what made sense. But now it's far more, you know, from our side, it's a guiding proposition that we develop with them and talk them down the road and tell them, you know, this is what you've got to commit to. This gives us every chance of success. We've tried this and that. This is what needs to happen to make sure that it gets off the ground. So, our thinking has evolved over time, but yeah, we've just made sure that internally we've been able to develop a platform that is easily customizable so that we can, you know, service all the necessary needs and wants of a partner and make sure that it gets off and going.
Just out of interest, I remember a couple of years back, I got hold of a book written by the founder of Endeavor, and they're doing some incredible work in the venture capital space and in really supporting entrepreneurs around the world. And she spoke about the kind of the period of time it takes for a startup to be recognized, for an organization that has a purpose-driven mission, for others to really recognize it, to really engage with it, to go through the cycle of kind of denial, anger, et cetera, until to get to that point where everyone gets the vision, where everyone can see how they can participate in it. And that time period she articulated was, and obviously it's an average with the, you know, quite a spread of anecdotal evidence, but the time period she spoke about was 8 years. So it's 8 very often lonely years where not everyone gets it, only a few do, and not everyone appreciates it or credits it in your valuation. And then something shifts fairly rapidly. You gain some sort of a critical mass among investors, and obviously that brings about it, you know, opportunities for further scaling. So I'm kind of just wondering, as you speak about the experience that you now have, that you and your team can have specific conversations with partners about what works and what doesn't, the kind of credibility that requires to shift a partner from perhaps what their model is, which could be very different to yours. There could have been failed attempts that they've had or attempts that haven't failed as yet, but if you can see a better way of doing it. Have you noticed a period of time it requires for your organization to command that kind of credibility and kind of active listening that a partnership is requiring to achieve its full scale? Or it really, you know, depends on the industry, the complexity of the solution, and there isn't kind of a rule of thumb around it. Should we be looking for the 8 years as a general guidepost, or your experience may be very different?
Yeah, I suppose it could turn into the 8 years. It could be make sense for certain parts of things. If I correlate it to partnerships, maybe I don't see it as clearly at this point in time, because it does seem like definitely where we've been in the market in the last couple of years, there has seemed to be this shift, and definitely not driven by ourselves, but definitely the shift of focus on SMEs and realizing that the benefit they play and that they've been underserved for a long period of time. And with that respect, it has made partnerships easier conversations than I assume it would have been very much in the early days. But having said that, in our early days, that wasn't a big focus for us. It was really around the direct business. But I think we've been pretty fortunate sort of as a business as a whole in terms of we obviously have global investors. They have really good and clear insight into other markets and, you know, what's happening there. And sort of credibility around what we are doing in our space has really been driven by markets where Mexico and Brazil, where companies similar to Lululand have been solving these challenges, you know, earlier than when we got going with things. And the investors have, you know, seen what has happened in these markets and the success of a lot of these businesses. And that's sort of translated into a lot of credibility for us and as an organization and in terms of what we're focused on solving for and that sort of thing. And that's made our lives a whole lot easier, you know, when we talk about fundraisers and that sort of thing. So I suppose I can definitely see it as a potential, you know, rule of thumb, but I think there's a lot of moving parts to it and areas that it might have more effects on than others. But I think we've just been fortunate in our timing that we've timed things pretty well, and there's been other leaders in other markets that have helped us, you know, scale up far, far easily.
Trevor, one could not but watch the news recently and the announcement that was made by, you know, a fairly acquisitive financial services group, Access Bank, coming into Southern Africa. And it's fascinating to watch how they've expanded in this region and more recently bought into GrowBank and made it now what is Access Bank South Africa. Now, you've had an ongoing relationship and formed a partnership, in fact, with GrowBank and what was previously called around alliance banking, around an offering that we're, again, focused on the SME market. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, the kind of benefits that you can now bring to the table or to a broader audience with SMEs in mind?
Yeah, so I think if we sort of go back to the start of the pandemic, we took a good look at our business, very much monoproduct business, focused on credit. We have multiple credit products out in market, but still a monoproduct business in terms of focus on credit. And that's how we look to solve for the SME. But, you know, in the early stages of the pandemic, we very quickly realized that SMEs need so much more support. Financial support and the ability to access cash flow is one thing, but it's so much bigger and deeper than that. And at the same time, if we looked internally at our business and where we were headed, we knew we had to, you know, continue to build something that was far more defensible, that, you know, there's going to be periods of credit appetite and there's going to be lulls. And although the pandemic didn't bring about a lull in credit appetite, it definitely did bring about a lull in terms of credit quality, in that it's very difficult to lend to businesses when there's such heavy restrictions that you don't know when your industry or your business is going to be able to trade again. So we really started reflecting on, this is where the business is at this point in time, but where do we see ourselves going in the future? And we really started building out, you know, what did the SME market in South Africa need? What was it lacking? And what did we feel we needed to build internally to make sure that we gave SMEs every chance of success? And we got on to, you know, actually what we need to solve for is developing a full neobanking opportunities. So the ability for us to be able to bank customers end to end. So a digital solution, but fully end to end, giving SMEs the ability to comprehensively bank and then build in, you know, really powerful tools on top of the banking opportunity through business financial management tools and that sort of thing to help an SME run a business and, you know that financial services for their business is taken care of and they can stick to, you know, running their construction company, their restaurant, whatever the case may be. So when we were, you know, armed with the understanding of what our sort of product roadmap looked like, it was the next big step in terms of identifying the necessary partners that we needed to help take us to market. So we knew we weren't going to go down the route of obtaining our own banking license because that costs tens of millions of dollars and can take, you know, 3 to 5 years, that sort of thing. And at the same time, we didn't want to compromise on the product and what we're able to bring to market. But we knew that there were other means for us to be able, you know, structure necessary partnerships for us to be able to get to market a whole lot quicker with a strong product that we believed in. And we started chatting to GrowBank, or they were GrowBank at that point in time, who have a very strong alliance banking division, and that's a big focus for their business. And at that point in time, we started engaging with them, and they were keen on the opportunity based on what we had already built. And they knew, you know, we had clearly communicated how we believed we could develop a comprehensive neo banking solution for SMEs, and they were bought in. But then we heard the news that, you know, Access Bank were looking to take over GrowBank. We obviously did our high-level due diligence in terms of what that meant for us. But all the signs were really positive that it would be potentially a really good scenario. And I'm happy to say, you know, a number of months in and with us, you know, live in beta with our product, that the opportunity with Access Bank has really actually taken things to another level. So Access Bank came into South Africa. You know, I don't think alliance banking was core to their business model, but they saw the opportunity in South Africa in terms of what GrowBank had already, you know, built the foundations of. And they've sort of gone in and taken it a step further and very commercial in nature in terms of how they think through partnership opportunities and what that means. But essentially, we are super excited to have them alongside us on this journey. And they're, you know, really open-minded in terms of what they believe can be built out from our side and ensuring that they're providing the necessary support to help us get there. So We're really excited to get live into market completely, which should be in the next month or two. And then, yeah, it's an exciting partnership that I think the South African market will hear a whole lot more about as we go further into it.
It kind of reminds me, a few months ago, we spoke with Benny van Rooy, who led Growbank. Also a fascinating conversation about their perspective around alliance banking and how he saw working with others and the kind of partnerships he was forging. Fascinating conversation. And Trevor, as we kind of get to the end of our conversation, and I feel, you know, we could spend another hour or two kind of expanding on this. There's so many fascinating aspects to growing an entrepreneurial and purpose-driven organization like yours. I guess something that you said right at the beginning, which was around kind of expanding your own networks, tapping into broader networks, whether around VCs, international investors, other entrepreneurial businesses, SMEs, et cetera, that was a big part of that period where Lula took shape. If I had to ask you, from the journey you've been on so far, when you speak to other early stage entrepreneurs, when you speak to others who have an idea, whether they're part of a corporate and they think of it from a corporate venturing perspective, or whether they're on the outside, what kind of insights or advice would you want to share with them, having gone through your journey?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you boil it all down, at the end of the day, you're ultimately just building for a customer, whoever that customer might be. And it's fundamentally understanding that customer. And that's the biggest sort of takeaway, and something that I still get our teams to focus on is that necessary in customer engagement. There's just a lot of entrepreneurs who go off and sort of build with ideas in their head without having those necessary conversations. And it's, you know, maybe not just one or two customers, it's, you know, you need a decent pool. And even if you don't have a product, it's just, you know, approaching the necessary people. So in our case, you know, SMEs, approaching 10 business owners and really just having those deep and meaningful conversations with them, you'll learn far more about, you know, what you need to solve for and what you need to be building through those conversations than anything else that, you know, in your mind you can muster up. Ultimately, you know, that's who we're solving for. The business owners or the customers, they're living their problem on a day-to-day basis. Some of them don't even realize it's a problem, and they just expect that this is how it's always been done, so this is how it should be done. And, you know, planting that seed of, you know, what if this had to happen, or what if this had to happen, and then getting the sort of light bulb moments on their side and going, well, actually, yeah, that sounds intriguing. You know, it's always been a problem for me, you know, if you think about this and that. And you sort of take all those ideas, and definitely for your first product, you know, it's going to build a whole lot more of a stronger product that, you know, when you eventually do go to market, gives it significantly more chance of takeoff. But then it's also not neglecting post that. So, you know, once that product is in market, having the necessary conversations with your customers. And I think, you know, what I've really learned, so I think sort of the mistakes that I made in the early days was not stopping the customer conversations, but listening to a lot of the sort of negative feedback and going, oh, okay, how do I fix the problems that these customers are talking to? Whereas the shift in the mentality is actually, you know, taking those customers that are really positive about your product and what you're building and engaging far more with them and helping them understand, you know, why is this meaningful to you? You know, what do you think needs to be developed over and above this? How can I make it better for you? And really focusing on that segment of customers to help take your product to the next level and help it become more of a success, versus focusing a lot of time and energy into those that, you know, are a bit lukewarm about what you've built and the impact will have on them. And you get into a bit of a spiral trying to solve for this customer base. But ultimately, you know, they're probably never going to be your customer long term. So if you're trying to get a product working for them and they're not that bought in, it could be sending you down the wrong path. So, you know, that will be my focus. Never take your eye off the customer. And just surrounding yourself with the right support. So again, we were very fortunate that we got onto these entrepreneurial venture capital investors that were focused on profit for a purpose. And they gave us, you know, a whole lot more, you know, wider scope thinking in terms of how we should be thinking through things. but at the same time, the necessary support. You know, not a typical VC model that in X amount of years you need to have 10x and we want an IPO or we want an exit scenario, whatever the case may be. Is, you know, understanding that these types of businesses, you know, perhaps do take a little bit longer, but the impact is far more impressive and far more meaningful in terms of what's being done in the market. I can't be more thankful in terms of, you know, how we are blessed with our investors and the support that we receive from their side, because, you know, when investors step into a business, and particularly if they've deployed a fair amount of capital and they've got a decent amount of weight, can very much change the initial founder, the entrepreneur thinking in terms of starting to build for what they want, versus having someone who's supportive of what you're trying to do and really just trying to guide you down the right roads versus telling you, you know, you need to be doing this and that, which, you know, I've heard multiple stories where businesses or business owners at least come into that position where they're a bit beholden to their investor base and in terms of making decisions that satisfy them versus, you know, ultimately what's best for the customer and best for the business as a whole long term. So those were important lessons for me as we've gone down this road.
Wonderful, Trevor. This is such a fascinating conversation. Lots of insights. And thank you for opening up and sharing from your journey in the business you've helped create. So really appreciate it. Thank you for making time for us today.
Only a pleasure, Saul. Thanks for having me.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.